Okay, thank you, Yinchen. Great to be here at Perimeter, especially in this beautiful room. So I'm going to talk about some old and some new work. The new work in collaboration with a number of people who I do want to mention. Ilya Estulets, who was a postdoc at Harvard and now faculty at Wisconsin. Hao-Yu Go, my former student, is now postdoc at Cornell. Avishkar Patel, my former student, who's now postdoc at Flatiron. Chen-Yuan Li, graduate student at Harvard, who is just graduating. And David Davide Valentinis and Jörg Schmalian at Karlsruhe. And Peter Luntz, who's a postdoc at Harvard. I guess he was at Perimeter many years ago. Okay, so this all refers to this famous phase diagram of the high-temperature superconductors. It's been around for a long time, and so you might wonder, why am I still talking about it? Well, there's still a lot of interesting open puzzles and also new experiments and new theories, which I think are continuing to shed a lot of light on this. So this is as a function of electron density or hole density in this compound. And for the purpose of this talk, we just think of this compound as a single layer of copper oxygen atoms on a square lattice. And we focus basically on the copper sites. And what happens at very low doping is that you get an antiferromagnet where the copper spins form this staggered spin arrangement. At high doping, the other well-understood phase at high doping is a Fermi liquid where all the electrons are inside here. That's the Fermi surface. And if you just treated the electrons as free electrons, you would get essentially what you're seeing in the experiments. So interactions are much more of a correction. All right, so then again, continuing across this phase diagram here, there's the famous pseudo-gap phase, which I won't say much about, except one or two transparencies, where you have some metallic state, which is definitely not a Fermi liquid in the traditional sense, partly because the Fermi surface looks strange. And it also has lots of the spin excitation spectrum is very far from that of a Fermi liquid. But anyway, I'm not going to say much about it. But the focus of the talk will be, well, before I get to that. So one thing that we have worked on quite a bit, but again, won't be the focus of this talk, is what happens when you start from these metallic states and you end up in the high-temperature superconductor. So if you start from here and go this way, well, that's the usual BCS theory. And at least qualitatively, if not quantitatively, it gives you pretty much the right picture. But we believe that there's nothing strange going on in the superconductor across this phase diagram. So you have to get very similar behavior starting from this bizarre metallic phase and get the same old superconductor. And that's also something we've been working a lot on in the last year or two. But my focus will be on the strange metal, as the title says. And for the whole dope cuprates, the most likely origin of this strange metal, that it is some kind of crossover between the pseudo-gap metal and the Fermi liquid. So then we'll have a possible zero-temperature phase transition, which has been obscured by superconductivity. But nevertheless, that zero-temperature phase transition is what's controlling the strange metal. So that sort of idea has been around for a long time, and we are now trying to make progress on actually connecting with experiments in making this a real theory that connects to data. So what is the strange metal then? So the strange metal has many strange properties. The most famous is the resistivity is a linear function of T. So this is more on the overdoped side. It's only showing the right half of the phase diagram that I just showed you. And there's a region here where the resistivity is approximately linear in temperature. N is the exponent that's shown in the color plot. And out here, it's a Fermi liquid where N is close to 2. But here, the superconductivity has been suppressed by by a magnetic field, and that's kind of where you see it. All right. And so that's for the whole doped cuprates. On the electron doped cuprates, you have a very similar type of phase diagram, where again you see some extended region in the overdoped side of strange metal behavior and Fermi liquid behavior here. Here they haven't actually, in the plot anyway, suppressed the superconductivity. But really the more important difference between the electron doped and the hole doped is that the antiferromagnetism seems to extend all the way into the optimal regime. So at least for the electron doped cuprates, if you want to then think in terms of some phase transition between two metals, it's much more appropriate to use a metal with antiferromagnetic order. Okay, so that sets up one very basic problem that a lot of us have been working on. And in fact, Sunsek has a very nice recent progress, really giving, you know, what seemed like very definitive answers to what happens at the critical point. So imagine tuning some parameter, which I'll call S. And when S is large, you have a Fermi liquid. And when S is small, you get antiferromagnetism. So now if you just do simple Hartree-Fock theory of the nature of antiferromagnetism in a metal, what you find is that this Fermi surface that was present in the large S regime breaks apart into smaller Fermi surfaces, electron and hole pockets. And this kind of Fermi surface is in fact seen in the electron doped cuprates. So here anyway, if you're searching for a quantum critical point at zero temperature to explain the strange metal, this seems like a very good candidate. And it's also much easier to understand than in the hole doped cuprates, where you have a rather mysterious pseudo-gap phase over here with no apparent order. At least for the electron doped cuprates, maybe things are simpler. Okay, here's one type of quantum critical point that, you know, on which a lot of progress has been made, and we want to now study it a bit further. For the purposes of the discussion, and also because it may be important in some other materials, here's another type of quantum critical point, although the simplest kind, really, that we might want to consider, where you have, again, tuning some parameter S, you have a Fermi surface here, which is square-like in shape, and in this case, there's an order parameter which makes it rectangular. So it's like an Ising order parameter because it'd be rectangular in the vertical or the horizontal direction, so there's a broken symmetry here. And again, we can ask about what's happening right near this quantum critical point. And, you know, that could be an explanation for a strange metal and some other materials. Some of the nicktys seem quite good candidates for this kind of quantum critical point. And the theory in details between this one and this one differ quite a bit. But the phenomenology of the strange metal seems to be very similar, and that's something I'm going to address. Finally, and you know, another example, coming back to the hole doped cuprates, this is my one slide about the pseudo-gap. So what is our picture of the pseudo-gap? Well, the picture of the pseudo-gap is that it's some kind of spin liquid state where you have these dimers floating around. This is a crude toy model. Some of the dimers are actual spin singlets, but the other dimers, the green ones, is basically just a single electron in a on a bonding orbital. So if you just look at the dimers in a colorblind way, it looks like a spin liquid with lots of resonating valence bonds. But if you just look at the colors, it's almost free fermions moving around. So this turns out to be one way to get a Fermi surface that looks like what you see in the hole doped cuprates without breaking any symmetry. And so there's a theory of all of this. And you can also try to think about the phase transition then between this kind of state that we call FL star to state called FL. So it turns out we have rather complicated gauge theory, but the central actor in the gauge theory that drives this transition is a Higgs field, some kind of boson phi, which when it's condensed, then you know it can condense in a way that you get a spin liquid state here, or if it, there's a the gauge field can just confine, and when it's confined, so that's like the Higgs phase, and this is the confining phase, where you get the Fermi liquid. Anyway, the only message that I want you to remember about this is that in the end, there's a boson which is driving this transition, much like this boson phi driving this transition. This is a physically observable boson. This is a little more mysterious boson, which has additional gate charges, so it's not directly observable. It's only observable through the change in shape of the Fermi surface.
So what's the experimental consequence of this gauge theory? There's some way to tell.
So there are a lot of, but I don't want to go into that. Okay, so there are, when in this, you can talk about in the pseudo gap, what are the consequences? Yeah, that's a whole nother talk. You can also talk about what are the consequences in the strange metal. And as you'll see, once you put in disorder, not much. It looks very similar to all the other theories. But in the pseudo gap, there's definitely consequences, and but that's a whole other talk. We can discuss later. Okay, so now for a while, I'm going to start with this simplest example, at least, which is the Ising pneumatic critical point. Just an Ising, just think of an Ising autoparameter, which is present in presence of a Fermi surface. And we want to then understand what's happening at the critical point, and maybe also at finite temperature. Okay. So how would we set up a theory for this transition? Well, if I had only the Ising autoparameter, we know how to do it. Landau, Wilson, and Fisher told us what to do. You just take your autoparameter and you write down a field theory, which is here. You have some gradient phi squared. You have some parameter S, which is the tuning parameter, multiplying phi squared and a phi to the fourth term. And then if you just take this field theory for the boson, then at the point where the boson becomes massless, you have all kinds of critical singularity and you get a conformal field theory, and books have been written on it and continue to be written. So that's thoroughly understood, the boson sector in this case. That's the usual Ising CFT. However, what's different here is that you also have additional low energy excitations on the Fermi surface. And they're still alive, not just on the left and the right, but even at the critical point. And they do have a very important coupling to this Ising CFT. It's a very relevant coupling. So you start out, you include the free fermions here, and then you couple this, you carve out type coupling between, which we call G, between the Ising degree of freedom and the fermion operator. Now, in this case, the operator is not just the fermion density. It's something more complicated with some additional indices here, but I've just dropped them just to not clutter up the slide, okay? It's not the density operator. It's the D-wave component of the density operator, anyway. But that doesn't make much of a difference at the level of the discussion I'm going to present today. Okay, so this is a very strongly relevant perturbation, and the reason it's strongly relevant is because its presence completely changes both the dispersion of the fermions and the bosons. And this was pointed out already by Hertz in 1976, I think, where in one direction the fermions give you Landau damping of the phi fluctuation, so it's not relativistic at all. And in the other direction, the bosons make the fermions non-Fermi liquid-like. They turn out to a very short lifetime, lead to breakdown of quasi-particles, and then the whole thing has to be done self-consistently. So if you want to learn the state of the art of that, I recommend Sung Sik's recent work of how all of that works. It's quite subtle, and a lot of work has been done. And I think Sung Sik's recent functional RG seems to have really clarified and brought many things together. Okay, so here's so that's, you know, for example, we believe the self energy is close to omega to the 2/3. So it's that's the for the fermions, and this explains the breakdown of quasiparticles. But one of the surprising things is that if you now, somewhat surprising, I mean, in retrospect, perhaps not, if you measure transport, even though the fermions are getting scattered a lot, if you measure transport in this kind of critical theory, it's essentially that of a perfect metal. So even though the single particle spectral functions can become very broad, if you look at transport, it's as if it's a perfect metal. And the reason is that, you know, it's a reason of what's sometimes called drag in electron-phonon problem. Yes, the electrons are scattering off the bosons very strongly, but the momentum is conserved in that process, and but the bosons are also scattering off the fermions, and so you might think that you, when you drive the current, that you've lost the current completely by a scattering process, but you haven't. It comes back to haunt you now, and in fact the current keeps going forever. So this is something that was already actually pointed out. Even it's also true for the electron phonon problem. You know, there's the famous Bloch's law for electron phonon, which is in fact what's observed in experiment, but the argument is totally wrong. And Pyles pointed out a year after Bloch that in fact there should be no resistance in there, and Bloch didn't quite have it right. Well, it turns out if you have a few impurities, you don't have to worry about the subtleties of drag, and the Bloch's calculation is correct, even though not completely internally consistent. And impurities save the day. But there, you know, the coupling between the electron and the phonon is rather weak, so you can just treat the whole thing perturbatively, and you really need an ultra-pure sample to see the phonon drag effect, which is only something been seen in the last 5 years by Andy McKinsey and others. But here, the coupling is not weak. It's extremely strong. And the reason it's strong is because the phi field is very strongly fluctuating. Anyway, so to summarize, if you study this critical point, and in fact also the other ones that I mentioned, then you do get some very interesting non-Fermi liquid behavior and a metal with no quasiparticles. But this regime above is not a strange metal. It's really a perfect metal in the type of theories I've described. Okay, so that's the introduction to my talk. This is where we are. All this beautiful work, but it still has not solved any basic issue in the observations of the strange metal. Okay. So this is the outline of my actual talk now. So what are we going to do? We're going to look at the effects of impurities in a variety of ways. I think they're all starting to come together, especially a lot of the theories are now being tested by quantum Monte Carlo, and it seems to be okay, but anyway. All right, any questions so far?
I have a question.
Yes.
How did you calculate the conductivity for this
This one? Well, at least there's many papers here that have looked at this. Our calculations are mostly done by Hi-Yu in this case. You have to basically sum a whole ladder diagram where you include all the vertex corrections, and that's where you find this behavior. But the fact that there is a delta function here, that you can see on rather general ground based on even the memory function formalism, for example.
So in the calculation, is it controlled?
What? Is the calculation controlled? Well, I mean, it can be controlled by putting all kinds of indices and taking some large n limit, but you know, that's not going to convince you. But there are general arguments based on water entries and conservation laws that, assuming this framework of the electron self-energy holds, that this should be, that there's going to be at least a delta function.
It really just comes from momentum conservation. Any system with momentum conservation that has non-zero charge density is going to have that.
Right, yeah, yeah. So that's what I meant by the memory function approach. If you buy the memory function approach, that tells you that if there's a non-zero overlap between the current and the momentum, you're going to have a delta function on it. I mean, you know, in the early days of ITC, there were a lot of papers written by very famous people I won't name, who basically immediately started with this omega to the two-thirds and concluded there was some power law in the conductivity, also corresponding power law with some modifications. Those papers are just simply incorrect, at least as far as the transport properties are concerned. And that's because I think the mistake was, you know, Bloch made a mistake and got away with it. And the reason he got away with it was the coupling was weak. But you cannot make the same mistake in a non-Fermi liquid. That is the important point. Okay, so now we're going to make life, there are two of them. Oh, I have to delete that slide, okay. Yeah, okay. So I'm going to first talk about a simple solvable model, which initially doesn't look like anything like any of the systems I've talked about, but we will, well, it looks sort of like it, but not quite. Then we'll slowly make it realistic and see how we understand, we claim we can understand the experiments. So the model I want to talk about is sometimes called the Yukawa SYK model. It's a cousin of the SYK model, and I won't talk about the SYK model because you may as well start. If history had been different, this model could have been discovered first. So in fact, this type of model, I believe, was first came up with in a discussion in the bistro downstairs I had with Davide Gaiotto when I was visiting Perimeter, and that eventually led to this paper a year or two later. At that time, we were discussing how to take the SYK model and make it supersymmetric. And he said, well, you can do it by adding a boson, Bose field, and putting this trilinear term, and that'll give you supersymmetry under right conditions. Later on, many people realized that you don't, supersymmetry is not essential to anything. You can just get the same behavior without supersymmetry. So here's the model in the end. You have fermions, which are sitting on some set of sites, and they have no dispersion. And then you have some an oscillator, harmonic oscillators, all have the same frequency omega zero. That's it. So fermions are in a flat band. All these are Einstein oscillators. They just have the same frequency. And now you couple them together, psi dagger I, psi j, phi l. And the coupling constant is taken to be a random number, basically. And you can take any distribution you want. The main assumption is that the couplings are statistically independent. That's really the main assumption. Every coupling is independently drawn from any other coupling. And it's nice to make the average zero, although that's, I don't think that's essential, at least in this simple model. Okay, so it turns out that this model with these random couplings is solvable in the large N limit. This particular model was solved by Ilya Eslitz and Jörg Schmalian in a very nice paper. And the large N limit turns out to be just the solution of these four equations. You have a Green's function of the fermion, the average Green's function of the fermion, and the average Green's function of the boson. So here, you know, of course, in the end, the values of the couplings do matter, and no one sample is not exactly identical to the other one. But the system is self-averaging. That is, even if you had just one sample, and you look at any given site in one sample, provided the sample is large enough, you will get the average answer. It's just self-averages very, very quickly because it's a model defined on, you know, a much larger, it's not, the size of the space is not n, it's e to the n. So you're averaging over e to the n quantum many body states, and that averages very quickly. And this has all been checked with numerics. It all works. So in the large n limit, and also lots of details of the finite n corrections are understood using the Schwarzschian theory and so on, but which also applies here, which I won't talk about. All right, so in the large n limit, at n equals infinity, the Green's function is only a function of time and independent of the site. It's completely site diagonal. So the self-energy correspondingly. And the same thing for the boson Green's function. It has its own self-energy. And then finally, the self-energy of the fermion and the boson are given by these very simple equations corresponding to these graphs, where the only thing you have to do is to make these Green's functions in here fully renormalized. So you have to, the whole thing has to be solved self-consistently. And equations like this, you know, probably were written down a long time ago. They call the Migdal-Eliashvili equations for this problem. But as Yorg said, nobody bothered to actually solve them completely. So if you sit down and solve them, and they're very similar to the SYK equations, you find that generically, the Green's functions have a power law decay, so you lose all semblance of the particles, where this exponent delta is given by the solution of some transcendental equation. Okay. So that's at zero temperature. You can also go to finite temperature. And you can also look at the case where these are real as opposed to complex. If they are real, this model also becomes a superconductor. So here's the kind of phase diagram that Ilya and Yorg showed. So there's this orange regime where you have the normal state, where you get this power law criticality that I showed you here. And then there's some higher temperature behavior where the system starts to decouple. But there's also a superconducting phase. I mean, so ultimately, the ground state is a superconductor, but you can suppress that by breaking time reversal symmetry. So there's also a superconductor. So, you know, this looks encouraging, at least qualitatively. There's a non-Fermi liquid, and there's a superconductor right near the non-Fermi liquid. But this is a model where there is no space. Everything is coupled to everything. There's no dispersion, rather artificial. But what's nice about it is, you know, apart from the fact that there's no dispersion here, no dispersion here, there's this Yukawa coupling. It's not so different from the theories I just described. You know, it's got the main interaction is psi dagger psi phi. And everything is coming from that. That dominates the physics. So it's a regime where you can really exactly solve a strongly coupled system, which is very rare. And you can solve it exactly and check everything. Okay. And, you know, 1 over n. So this turns out to be also the low energy theory of this is the same as the low energy theory of a charged black hole in 3 plus 1 dimensional space at very low energies. That's a whole other talk that I can give some other day. All right, so that's all I have to say about the SYK models. And so there was all this work, and we started thinking, okay, how can we use this to solve an actual problem that might relate to the cube rates? There was quite a lot of work in many different directions. Some of it was generalizing the SYK model. But once we started thinking about generalizing the Yukawa SYK model, suddenly things at least seemed to move for us in some positive direction. Okay, so let's go back to the actual model, the Hertz type theory for a scalar field coupled to the Fermi surface. And modulo some details, I mean, I want to say that similar theory also applies for the for this FL star, this more exotic phase transition. That's got additional gauge fields that are not obviously shown, but they turn out not to be so important once you put in disorder. So what kinds of disorder are natural in the physical system? Well, the most common disorder, which is the basis of millions of papers, I would say, in condensed matter physics, is just a random impurity. Take V of R to be some function which is delta correlated in space. So it's fixed once and for all, and then you solve for the dynamics in the presence of this. So when if you have free electrons, this is already very interesting. V of R leads to Anderson localization. If you put in interactions, it can lead to metal insulator transitions, and so on. And you can also get the theory of the disordered Fermi liquid with all kinds of singular corrections coming from the interplay between V of R and the long-range part of the Coulomb interaction, and so on. So that's a whole well-developed subject. And now we want to ask, what is the role of the V of R near the critical point? So near the quantum critical point of some scalar field, that hasn't been studied very much. I mean, it has, but when people started looking into this, including us, probably about a decade back, it was immediately became clear that there's another disorder that's much more important. Once you are near a quantum critical point, and that disorder is this one here. So this is like the mass disorder. It's simply telling you that here you're on the right side of the critical point, there you're on the left side of the critical point. The position of the critical point can be different at different points in space, and that's a very relevant perturbation to the entire critical theory. Yeah, those are not as relevant, at least near the non-Fermi liquid fixed point. This is definitely the most relevant. I mean, it's closely connected to V of R. You have to really keep them both. But this is, I mean, K disorder or U disorder, they're not supposed to be that important.
So do you mean there are more relevant disorders, but this one is the most relevant one?
Yes.
Then should we keep one of them?
Well, so the point, it depends. If you solve the theory exactly, you only need to keep one, because one will generate the others by symmetry under some RG. But if you're going to do some approximation, well, you better keep the best, the most important ones, because in the approximation, it will be better. Okay, that's all. So it's a bit of an art. You want to keep things that are compatible with the fact that you're making a certain approximation. So you want to keep the things that will work well with your particular approximation. Okay. So the first step, which a lot of us took, was, well, let's keep delta S. And then you find it just flows off to infinity. And at that point, you throw up your hands. Well, I don't know what to do. That's kind of what, kind of where things were for a while. And people did something with small delta S, but it didn't look that convincing or didn't look like any experiment. And anyway. We turned to holography. We started looking at holographic theory. We were putting delta S and see what happens there. But then you lose contact with the microscopic physics. Yeah, okay. So more recently, inspired by all the progress on the Yukawa SYK model, we said, okay, in the Yukawa SYK model, all the disorder was here, not there. So we say, okay, well, wait a minute, this is so important. Maybe this is the only thing that's important. Well, if that's the only thing that's important, you can just rescale phi and just move it here. Okay? I mean, you'll generate disorder and everything else, but let's not worry about that for now. And just put it over there. Okay, so now we're getting a theory that's almost like the Yukawa SYK model. The only real difference is that the fermions have a dispersion, the bosons have a dispersion, there's this tuning parameter and so on, but all the disorder and the non-linearities are essentially the same. So you can now also dress this up with indices to decide some formal large n, but really it's a physical argument. that we can now solve it by the same set of equations that you used to solve the Yukawa SYK model. So would this be okay? So the question is this going to be okay that you go from here to there? Is that allowed? So what we conjectured was, yeah, so this I've already said, it should be okay as long as the right eigenmodes of phi are not localized, that they're all extended. And they're everywhere, and so they're also going to, since they're everywhere, they're going to average over the disorder. So what we're going to do is just treat the disorder in some kind of average way. Is that good enough? Okay. So what do we do? Well, we just apply the SYK method, which is that, you know, exactly like what I showed you for the Yukawa SYK model, except now, in general, the Green's function, well, it certainly has a dispersion, but even the self-energies can depend on momentum. That's because there's two different types of terms in these two, in the self-energies. One comes from the spatially uniform coupling. That's the coupling G here, which we didn't have in the Yukawa SYK model the way I defined it. So this is the spatially uniform part. This is the average zero part. The spatially uniform part conserves momentum. As a result, the R index is the same here. And this is when you Fourier transform this, this leads to a self-energy that depends on momentum. On the other hand, the G prime and the V terms are much simpler. They only act at when the Green's function is right at the origin in the separation of the coordinates. And so these things, when you Fourier transform, are independent of momentum. And they're, you know, but you do have to keep the dispersion in. Anyway, so these are the exact analog of the SYK type, Yukawa SYK equations. There's just another momentum and frequency floating around. All right, so these equations, you can, yes. Go ahead. Is it, say that again? What even by control? I mean, can there? Okay, so what I'm doing here right now is I'm making the SYK or Migdal-Eliashvili approximation to write down these expressions. These are valid to all orders in G and G prime because the whole thing is self-consistent. But they're not easy to solve. These equations in general are not so easy to solve. And in fact, even today, we haven't solved them completely because of the both frequency and momentum dependence. In a few minutes, I'll present some results where we solve them completely by putting little g equals zero. But what we can do and what we did do in our first paper was solve these equations order by order in G and G prime, and that was the next slide. So now we're going to make a second approximation. We've already made the large N approximation. Now we're going to do perturbative in G and G prime. That we can do analytically. And it turns out that actually gives you pretty much, we believe, the full picture. So what happens perturbatively? Thank you. What happens perturbatively? Well, if you compute the electron Green's function, the self-energy, this is what you find. You get some, inelastic scattering here. Sorry, you get some lifetime. This has two pieces. There's the elastic scattering piece, which just depends on the impurity potential. That's the usual Drude formula that you learn in every solid state physics class. Then there's the inelastic piece. That comes both from G and G prime. And it has a frequency dependence, which is linear in frequency. In a Fermi liquid, this would be omega squared. So this is the marginal Fermi liquid behavior. And correspondingly, there's an effective mass that has a logarithmic dependence on frequency. So this is what people call marginal Fermi liquid spectrum, as observed, for example, in many papers, including this one right here. All right. Now we can also compute the conductivity, which involves, looking at all of these graphs, which is more complicated, but perturbatively in GNG prime, you can do it. And when you do it, you find the following result. You get sigma of omega has another scattering time, which I now call tau trans. And similarly, so this is just like the Drude formula, except the scattering time and the effective mass are frequency dependent. And so if you look at the transport scattering rate, which is this quantity here, and compare it to the electron scattering rates, there's the Drude term, the V squared, that's present in both, fine. That's if you just keep the V squared term, you get the Drude formula. Sigma is N E squared tau over M. But if you look at the marginal Fermi liquid correction, this is computed in the limit of large V, because there's a V in the denominator. Here you had the electron scattering rate had contribution both from G and G prime. And this is the main point. Here, the G cancels out. Because we learned already at the beginning of my talk that a uniform system without any disorder and but very strong interaction doesn't give you any resistance. But here there is a resistance, and resistance entirely coming from G prime. And it's linear in frequency, so when you translate that to temperature, it's linear in temperature, and so on. So you get this whole host of properties, which are controlled by the values of V, G, and G prime, which are just free parameters to us at this point, but at least qualitatively, if not quantitatively, all of those properties are exactly what you see. Also, you can see from this analysis that you get the same results whether you take any one of the three quantum critical, clean quantum critical points I talked about, Ising pneumatic, spin density wave, the boson coupled to gauge field. All of this works quite universally. Once you put in disorder, the boson propagator has a diffusive form at the critical point, and it just follows from that. So in the end, it's very simple. Okay, so what we have done in a paper to appear soon is to now look at a simpler model where we don't make this perturbative approximation, but we drop the G because, well, that's very hard. And we've already seen it's not important for transport. So at least to order G squared, we know we can throw out G. So we just throw it out. Because just to make life simpler.
Do you mind ask what is G and G prime?
Here. Okay. So G is the spatially uniform term. G prime is the root mean square value of the random term. Okay.
What's the intuition in the setup with the gauge field? The carbon to gauge field is not important.
Well, I mean, because you're only interested in, you two can be charge transport. The charge transport only involves the gauge invariant electrons in that case. There are various other spin-on or ghost Fermi surfaces and so on. But because those are also disordered, the boson the boson will mix the electron to the spin-on Fermi surface. But because everything is disordered, the boson propagator is always Q squared plus mod omega. There's no, it's not mod omega over Q or anything like that. So, and the boson has to be massless at the critical point. So basically, in the end, you end up with electrons coupled to a boson with 1 over Q squared plus mod omega. The gauge fields really make no difference. They affect the gauge charge particles, but the gauge charge particles are not the ones contributing to transport. Okay. Yes. It really is that simple. All right, so here I want to show, so there's been a lot of work. How am I doing on time? Okay. A lot of work on measuring the optical conductivity as a frequency and temperature in the cuprates. In particular, Doug von der Merrill published a paper in Nature seeing this omega to the 2/3 power law, which was supposed to be in agreement with the omega to the 2/3 self-energy, and people were starting to feel good about it. But around the same time, that theorists were realizing there is no omega to the 2/3 power law in the theory, Dirk's team was realizing there is no omega 2 third power law in the experiment either. It's funny how that happens. He didn't know about our work. We didn't know about his work. But anyway, we all came to the same conclusion at the same time. So this is the actual data. This is the absolute value of the conductivity was the frequency. This is the phase of the conductivity with frequency. There is an apparent power law close to two-thirds here. That's due to some, you know, that's really, they understood in this paper that was published last year that this is not really a power law. It's due to log corrections in the effective mass, which is exactly what our theory says, that there's a log term in the effective mass, and that log term, and this is what they concluded independently of us, that the log term is what's masquerading as a power law. So they were not trying to fit our theory, which is even better, because this is what they concluded by looking at the data more carefully and analyzing both the real and imaginary parts. So this is the real, the absolute, the modulus, and this is the phase. And if you take our theory at G prime equals zero, you know, you get very similar results. Then you can look at, so now you know the value of K. So you take 1 over sigma, and you take the imaginary part of that, one of the real part of it, that gives you 1 over tau of omega. So this is the raw data for 1 over tau of omega as a function of frequency and different temperatures represented by the colors. Now you just rescale 1 over tau by kVt and also frequency by kVt. This is so-called Plankian regime, and you get very good collapse. But it does seem to be scaling, but with a power of 1, not 2/3 or anything like that. And you know, that's great, because as you see here also, 1 over tau, the tau transport is power 1. It doesn't have any logs. The logs are in the, I should put trans here. What I'm measuring is the transport quantity. So anyway. Sorry? Yeah, well, these are at rather high frequencies. There is an offset that I've forgotten now. If you look at 1 over tau, let's see, if you go to zero frequency, there is still some scattering rate here that's coming from the V term. Now, I think here they probably just subtracted out the V term. I'm not sure. Or dividing by KT. I have to go back and look what they did with the V term. Anyway, so this is our calculation. I think this is a calculation at V equals zero. This is the raw data, and when you scale it, you know, it doesn't look too bad. There is some scaling. Then what they found in the M star quantity here, you get here, if you look at it as a function of temperature, it's log dependent on temperature, the optics, and that's exactly what the theory says. The specific heat has also a log T, and that's also what our theory gives. The scaling doesn't work very well, just as you expected, and this is kind of our data, but the scaling doesn't work very well. Anyway, so you may not be impressed by the fit, but believe me, we are very delighted, because it's been very, very hard to get anything even close to the experimental data and anything else. And we're just taking some, you know, very simple theory at this point. Of course, we can try to make it more quantitative and so on. Okay, so now part three. So in the past year or so, we've been going back to this issue of, you know, can you really just rescale phi and forget about the disorder in the random mass term? And one reason you can't forget about it, because even this theory, the new theory that we have, it's the self-averaging, still violates the Harris criterion. So there's got to be some effect in the end. So then there was also this calculation by Matt Foster and others, who started with the theory with just the V disorder and started looking at, interference between localization type corrections and the critical phi fluctuation. And they found that there was something very singular correction in their calculation. And this again was a signal that we really have to go back and look at the effects of disorder on the boson propagator a little more carefully. So that's what we've done in our recent work. So now this is the question, of course, does this mapping work? And it would only work if the phi states are self-averaging. So we try to address it in basically the old Hertz theory. We just imagine we integrate out the fermions. Then the Hertz theory, the fermion just gives you this mod omega damping of the boson. So the top line is the Wilson-Fischer theory. This for now for a multi-component order parameter with m components. This is just the Wilson-Fischer theory. Then you put in a random mass term. So Wilson-Fischer with random mass has also been studied a great deal, except this random mass only depends on position and not on space, and not on time. So it's like random lines. Take Wilson theory and you put random lines everywhere. That's a much harder problem. I don't think it's fully solved, although there have been many papers on it. Han Ma, I think, has written a paper on it. She's away. And then there's damping coming from the fermions. All right, so we just want to go back and look at this carefully and see if there's how important are these random mass terms. So based on some work we've done earlier, we decided to just solve this theory in a very simple approximation. Now, this kind of approximation would be completely ridiculous in the clean system of the Wilson-Fischer fixed point. It's just essentially mean field theory. But here, the point is that the disorder is so important. The interactions are sort of secondary, although you can't get rid of them. You must treat the disorder exactly, but you can get away with a relatively weak treatment of the interactions, some self-averaging way. So we take this theory and approximate it by a Gaussian theory, and then there's some variational answer that the renormalized mass, this S bar, is related to the bare mass, which is this S here, by the expectation value of phi squared. That just comes from decoupling this quartic term. And phi squared is then computed self-consistently for this action. So basically, this whole thing here is a self-consistent equation for S bar. You pick an S bar prime, then you diagonalize this form. When you diagonalize this form, you get the wave function psi and the eigenvalues E alpha. And then you compute the S bar and you keep going round and round. So Avishkar developed some very fancy methods to do this using finally putting GPUs to good use other than ChatGPT. This takes a big computer and it's amazing how big a sample they can do. so they have a lot of GPUs at Flatiron, luckily. And so you do this calculation. And I'll show you some results. This is already published, about to appear. Okay, so for example, if you look at the correlation length of the boson, it shows a nice crossing point. So there's your quantum critical point, crossing point with temperature. Look at these beta values, 320, and the system size is about 200. So this is really a really big study. And then what you can do is you sit at this critical point and you look at these eigenfunctions. So these are the eigenfunctions of your critical boson. So eigenfunctions as a function of energy E alpha. Okay. You look at these eigenfunctions and then ask how extended are they? And there's a way of computing can call the participation ratio, and from that you get some length scale, which I'm just calling the localization length, or L alpha. And this is what they look like as a function of energy. So and this is a log scale. So for most of the energy range up here, they are extended because of the localization length is of order the system size, and this is kind of what they look like. This is the wave function of the boson fluctuations. But then you actually have a minimum where they become localized. They've been very short fluctuations. And this, you know, is not, certainly these localized states are not part of the theory I presented so far. The theory I presented, we believe, well, let's see, did I miss something? Yeah, so it applies. So the theory I presented probably is okay here. In fact, we've quantitatively checked it, and it just works just fine. Whereas here, who knows? And then we would see something rather strange. In fact, I anticipated this would appear before the calculation was done. Anyway, but I'm presenting it as a mystery. The localization starts to increase again. You get, it's as if these localized modes are starting to couple with each other at lower energies and getting things that are again becoming extended. But it's a very slow increase. It's only logarithmic in energy. What is this due to? All right, so what is this due to? Well, in fact, we can understand all of this by a very nice earlier paper, which had been forgotten by almost everybody except us, I suppose, by Hoyos, Cotopaxi, and Wojta. So what they were looking at, exactly the same random Hertz theory. They put in a random mass, but they also put in a random hopping for the JIJ. Okay, so they looked at this theory, and you integrate out the fermions, and you get a mod omega damping. So we are interested in the interplay of the Landau damping and the random mass and the boson self interaction. All three have to be kept for this thing to make sense. Okay, so how did they solve it? They said, well, let's assume that this has a very broad distribution, and these J's also have a very broad distribution. And then you pick the extreme value. This is called the strong disorder RG. You pick the extreme values, and then you integrate out degrees of freedom near the extreme values, and you keep doing that. And this has to be done, you know, if the disorder is really strong, you can do it one step of the RG analytically, but then you have to numerically solve the RG equations because you have an equation for an infinite number of variables, all the Jij and the Sj. You have to really solve those. It is not easy to solve. But one of the things they showed was that to leading order, the strong disordered RG for the Jij and the S was exactly the same, amazingly, for the strong disordered RG for completely different problem. And that problem was the Ising model in a transverse field. You know, this is the model that D-Wave is building. And who knows, everybody else. Whether it's some random, it's Ising just qubits with some all same sign coupling Jij and a transverse field. Daniel Fisher in particular showed that this particular model in any dimensions has this the same RG equations. All right, this sounds rather mysterious, and why does this happen? Well, I can spend some time talking about it, but I'm out of time. Yes, I'm out of time. Let me just give you some idea of what's going on. So let's talk about the Ising model first. So the Ising model first is that, let's say you pick a region where the Jij are very large, you want to pick, here you also have to renormalize the Ji. You pick a region with the Jij very large. And so you got this rare region here, but the spins are very big, and they're starting to order because it's become a huge moment in that region, collective moment. And now they're going to fluctuate in time. So if you just look at this droplet and look at its fluctuation in time, it's as if from the transverse field, it's as if you've got a 1D classical Ising chain at very low temperature. The effective temperature is very low because the moment is large. And now that's a problem that's been solved. So the 1D classical Ising chain at very low temperature, we know has no order, but the correlation length grows exponentially, e to the 1 over t. You know, that's what Ising discovered that, as you lower the temperature. Okay, now let's do the same thing for this problem. Again, imagine you have some region, some droplet where phi is almost condensed, and now it fluctuates in time. Now, because of the Landau damping, when you take the Fourier transform of the Landau damping, you get a 1 over tau squared interaction. So you have to solve the problem of a 1D, let's say, XY chain, classical XY chain, with 1 over R squared interactions. Okay, that is a famous problem that was solved by Kostelis right after he wrote the Nobel Prize winning paper with Thouless. He realized that the same method could apply here. So what Kostelis showed, and around the same time, Polyakov was solving the ON model in two dimensions. You take the 1D classical Ising chain, you do kind of a Polyakov-style RG on it, not Ising, XY chain. It has to be a continuous symmetry. If you take a 1D continuous symmetry chain with 1 over R squared interaction, that also has an exponentially large correlation length, e to the 1 over t. And that's the reason these two problems are the same. So there's kind of an exact cancellation of two effects. So this system has a discrete symmetry and no damping. It's an insulator. This system has a continuous symmetry and damping. Continuous symmetry enhances fluctuation. Damping suppresses fluctuation. And they exactly cancel each other, at least to leading order in the correlation, diverging correlation. Anyway, so that's why these problems are the same. And so now what happens in this problem? Well, this was already, this particular model has been studied in two dimensions, for example, by these people. And what they find is that, you know, you get these clusters, which start to then inter, you get one cluster here, they start to interact, and then you renormalize further, and then further ones interact, and the energy scale keeps going down. So this kind of logarithmic divergence of the localization length was in fact proven by Daniel Fisher in one dimension and was seen numerically in, even in two dimensions. And we see it numerically from this chat GPT, you know, the GPU calculation, sorry. Really require, I mean, this you required a big system size, and but not much averaging. I think this is data from about 10 samples. All right, so great, and this is forthcoming work by Avishkar, Peter, and Michael Albergo, where they took this particular theory. I mean, it's the full theory with fermions, with some dispersion. Really, the only thing is that they made the coupling fully random and zero mean. So G is zero, but G prime is not zero, and they just solved this completely by Monte Carlo. You ask, you know, why don't they put in a G2? Well, you can. It doesn't, but somehow, for reasons I don't fully understand, the equilibration in Monte Carlo is not as good. So right now, they're looking at the simplest case where G prime is zero. I presume they will put the G in there later. And so there's a whole bunch of results coming out, which they should really talk about it. But one of the things that they were seeing, which is what led me to the calculation I've just described, that the localization length has the same non-monotonic behavior. This is the full theory, no approximations other than putting G equals zero. And you see the same non-monotonic behavior in the localization length. In our theory, we can also compute perturbatively the self-energy and the transport. You can do the self-energy as a function of frequency, more detail. You can analytically continue exactly. That's the advantage of the random mass theory. And what you see is that in addition to the quantum critical region, there's now a foot that's developing in the non-Fermi liquid behavior. The resistivity, you know, you see it's approximately linear in T everywhere here, then it becomes T squared out there. Of course, yeah, I'll come back to that in a minute. And so that foot is what, you know, we're optimistic that now we can, this, what's going on here can also be understood. And so the SYK physics is this higher temperature, intermediate temperature behavior, and a very low temperature, there's entirely new effects coming from strong disorder. And that is what leads to the famous foot. Okay, that's our proposal. I don't think we've fully established that, but it's all looking quite promising, shall we say. What we'd love to see is some actual measurements. Some, you know, we're hoping that these, you know, this localized modes here, you know, we know something about the density and the distribution. It can be seen in some experiments, some nanoscale experiments, or even average experiments can see this. We have some estimates of the density of states of these things and so on. So let's see. there has to be some. And along the same lines, I should, this one slide that I skipped. There was a proposal a bit earlier than our last paper by the authors listed there, where they, well, here's the picture of what they're doing. They imagine that you have some localized modes. They call them two-level systems on some with many colors. So that's to take the large end limit. So you have a bunch of two-level systems, localized, coupled to electrons that are moving around. And in this particular model, they can get, you know, some extended non-Fermi regime, which depends on the distribution of the energy levels of these two-level systems. So, you know, that's similar to our picture, except I would say we are not putting anything by hand. We're just taking the Hertz theory with random mass, that's all. And we get similar looking physics with actual predictions for distributions of these things, at least numerically. Okay, I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
So, we can take a few questions.
Yes, so I understand what you're saying about the disorder. You're saying that, like, even if microscopically the disorder is quite weak, because it's this mass term is strongly relevant, you can still get this marginal from the result. Is it possible to be quantitative about, like, how big should the disorder be microscopically?
I mean, in the context of the large n approximation, we can, but we have these numerical results from which we can try to be more quantitative. I agree, but yes, your point you made is, I think, yes, I'm in resonance with that. So the idea, roughly speaking, is the most important thing is a random mass term, and over a certain temperature regime, not the very lowest temperature, you can account for the increase in the random mass by putting it into the random coupling. You can just rescale it away and put it there. And this is the regime where the states, bosonic states, are all extended. And that's this regime up here. I mean, we just know that, you know, that such a regime exists is what's shown by this data. I mean, this shows that there is such a regime. This whole regime here, where we are getting, basically, you can get the same physics from by just doing the calculation with a random coupling. So that's the first regime. So the random mass starts to grow. First, it goes into the Yukawa SYK regime, let me call it that. And then eventually it becomes so large that you go into the Vojta et al. Regime, the Hoyos et al. Regime, where you really have to take a strong disorder point of view and think of it in terms of these localized modes, which have some similarity to what appears in the random feelizing model. That's the picture. Yeah.
So in the case of Kiepert, so what is the source of this random?
Any impurities, yeah, anything.
Impurities will do it, then.
Yes, anything. It's, you know, normally you think of impurities as giving a lifetime of the electrons, but if you're near a quantum critical point, you're in some nearly critical system, they also have the effect of moving the position of the critical point around. And that's what we are using.
Random doping would sort of do it?
Well, it could be the oxygen atoms out of layers. Yes, also those two, no. But I think, you know, Dominic's onto an important point, which is they are still, at the level of the effective theory, there are many different terms. And it could be certain impurity, types of impurities affect some of the others, one or the other terms more. So these are things, you know, hopefully we'll study, but to get really quantitative at this point, I don't know how to get around the quantum Monte Carlo type calculations.
Quality, like, you know, we know that in the copper oxygen planes is quite different than oxygen.
Sure. Yeah. Well, all of those affect all three, but, you know, I would say that more longer wavelength disorder will have a more of effect on the random mass, whereas a short wavelength disorder will have more of an effect on the V of R on the electron. So I think that you can kind of see. Yeah. Okay. There's a question here, and then we'll come to you in the online. Yes.
Thank you for the talk. In the first introductory slides, you mentioned about going from hole light to electron light, and that you would not comment on it. There was this on this slide, right? Does this give us some insight into that change in the nature of the Fermi surface? You know, like the Fermi surface transformation. This, like, just the log divergence.
Yeah. So let me just recall a few things. So when I was talking about the clean system, okay, I mentioned three different quantum critical points.
Yes.
So one quantum critical point is antiferromagnetism. You're losing antiferromagnetism and get going from a small pocket Fermi surface to a large Fermi surface. That's one quantum critical point. This, let's say, to zeroth order is what applies to the electron doped rates. The second quantum critical point is just the pneumatic transition where the Fermi surface is going from being square-like to rectangular-like. It's a tetragonal orthorhombic transition driven by electronic degrees of freedom. And, you know, I think the iron nictide FESC may be something that's, yeah, it's the Pomeranchuk transition. All right. And the third transition was a topological transition involving change in the Fermi surface due to the emergence of topological order in the lower doping site. This is my favorite transition for the whole doped cup rates. All right. So for these transitions in the pure system, if you work out the theory of these transitions, this transition, they have some common features. One common feature is they have a Fermi surface. The second common feature is that they have a Bose field, phi, little phi or capital phi, and then they have a Yukawa coupling. But there are the form factors and many other things are different. And those other things are very important in the clean system. And so you end up getting three different universality classes with very different type of exponents in these three systems. Now, I haven't shown this in my talk, but I've claimed this. If you take any one of these three systems and put in the random mass disorder, you get the same behavior.
Yeah.
Yes. All three of them give the same. It's like a super universality class.
Yeah, the question was
sorry.
Is it in the archive or
what?
Did you discuss that or is like
Yeah. This is everything I've said here except, well, a few things are not. This numerical work here, this should be out hopefully in a month or two, maybe less than a month. This stuff here, this is not out yet. And then the work of Peter and Avishkar, this part, this is not out yet. This is to appear, but everything else is on.
You mentioned this time fluctuations in the temporal regime.
Yeah.
As an experiment, just like, I mean, I don't know like exactly how to think about like what scale time scales are you thinking, but let's say if somebody does like it checks quantum fluctuations or like things like those, like what would be the time scales for?
Well, I mean, so let's see. Yes. So what is it? So if you take our, you know, this is some arbitrary units, but let's look at this plot, for example. So these localized modes here seem to be correlated with this foot extending out here. Okay. So now if I look at the actual data, that foot, you know, appears around 30, 40 Kelvin. So I would say that is the typical, you have these two-level localized modes. We would say they are 3 to 4 MeV. That's where they are.
So
yeah.
So the theory with the G equals zero,
on average has a double symmetry because you can rotate fermion and boson independently.
Theory with G equals zero.
Uniform coupling is zero.
On the average.
Yeah. What makes the theory more attractive?
No, I don't think so. We're not really using that symmetry. I mean, we're at the critical point. Well, I mean, you take a large n limit where, just like here, I mean, rigorous, I should say, to derive the Migdalia-Lajpak equations, the one minor insight we have had is that you can derive the Migdalia-Lajpak equation as the large n saddle point of this type of Yukawa-Syk theory. So if you take a Yukawa-Syk theory where you have no space, but you have some fictitious flavor index, IJL, then the large n limit of this is exactly these equations. And that's actually been numerically established, also checked. It works perfectly. There's quantum Monte Carlo studied at finite n. There's all kinds of things. So that works beautifully. So now, all we are doing, so you have these indices here. Now just imagine them as some fake, they're not physical indices, they're some fake flavor indices. And now all we're doing is you're putting in some gradients here and some gradients here, and that's about it. So that makes things also a function of momentum. And then we take the same large n limit here. So when you take the same large n limit, instead of getting these equations, you get these equations. It's the same equations, except, in fact, if you take only the blue terms here, then they're almost, that's the simpler equation, because these things conserve moment, are momentum independent because of the delta function. These are the more difficult terms. So what you have been working on is remove all the blue terms. Then you will get essentially you will get the original large n equations, for example, omega to the 2/3 and everything else that you showed didn't have a systematic large n expansion. In this random flavor model, that problem doesn't appear. And if you drop the blue terms, you will get the omega to the 2/3 and all of that. If you drop the red terms here, then you'll get a marginal Fermi liquid. And then what we've shown is that if you include both the blue and the red term, you still get a marginal Fermi liquid, both in transport and So in the end, everything I've told you, at least in the middle part of my talk, just comes from solving these equations and then summing these graphs for transport.
Just
fully self-consistently.
For the transport properties, are the analytical results for optical transport and the numerical results for DC transport?
Well, there's a variety of results. So if you now take these equations and now do a second expansion in G and G prime, these are analytic. I mean, there's a whole bunch of coefficients we know. I didn't put them up here. You can get every term here exactly the right coefficients. Then what we can do is, it's possible to solve these things. All right, what happens is suppose I put in a G, then you have to solve sigma of k and omega and pi of k and omega and so on. It's doable. People have done much harder things before, but it's a lot of time. It can be done. But then it also happens that when you compute the transport, once you have a non-zero G, you really have to look at all these terms. You cannot drop these terms. And that's a really hard task. So do full Bethe-Salpeter equation self-consistently with frequency and momentum-dependent self-energies. I don't think anyone's really done that. I don't want to ask any student or postdoc to spend their life on that. Sorry?
Even at zero temperature.
Yeah, it's probably pretty hard. But we can do it order by order, and we can see that every order, its behavior is the same. I mean, yeah. What we can do completely, numerically, this is what's going to be published in a paper to come out soon, is just the full solution of the red terms here. Full solution where you keep only the blue terms on the right-hand side. And of course you keep, this is just the Dyson equation. We solve that completely. And then the transport is also easy because all the vertex corrections vanish. And that's how we get all of these results. And they already look exactly like the data. Well, exactly. They look really very much like the data. So we are pretty happy.
Yeah. At the finite temperature, do you always need to rely on numerical calculations?
You can always, perturbatively, you can reduce everything to solution of some, you know, you give a bunch of gamma functions and you have to solve some equation involving gamma functions using Mathematica, things like that.
Can I ask the previous question, but maybe in a different way? In the limit of zero solar, then you get back to the clean results.
Okay.
Like, how does that limit, like, how do you reach that limit? Do you know that?
Well, that is, so for example, well, how do you reach that limit? So the boson propagator, you can roughly think of it as, it's Q squared, and in the clean limit for the pneumatic is mod omega over Q. This is what it is. So what happens in the disordered regime that this is not Q, Q is 1 over L, so some mean free path. So you can imagine that this is equal to max of 1 over Q times the mean free path, or min. Is it min or max? So when the mean free path is very short, the Q has to become really large, so it's the min. Okay, so this is what you have. So if you're looking at wave vectors larger than the mean free path, then you get the clean limit behavior, which in this case, the clean limit behavior would be essentially that in Polchinski. And then Hayu has recently solved the full integral equation, the clean limit, and you've also looked at that, and so on. So you'll get the same, right. But on the other, once the mean free path takes over, once the mean free path takes over, then it's just diffusive. And then you go over to marginal Fermi liquid physics. So there's some complicated crossover there.
Okay, so that's a lot of questions. So thanks to you again.
Sure.